The Mystic Pete Chronicles. We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview the very interesting Mike Gormley and play music from artists he's worked with. We started the show with Ladies from Hell. That was an instrumental by Jeff Skunk Baxter. And then after the interview, Masterpiece by Trevor McShane. Then Do It Again by Jeff Skunk Baxter. And wrap up the show with She Said by Trevor McShane. Stay tuned. It's November 14th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Mike Gormley. You have a very interesting history and you're up to some exciting deeds. Why don't you introduce yourself, explain what you're doing, and then we'll figure out how you got there.
Okay. I haven't figured out how I got there yet, but that's...
By the end of this interview, we will have figured out all of the magic that got you here.
Okay, great. Well, presently, for a long time, I've been an artist manager, and I've managed the careers of I managed Oingo Boingo, and I talked Danny Elfman into becoming a composer during that time.
I remember seeing them in the late 70s, and they'd come on with monkey masks.
Yeah, that was the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo. That was the street theater thing. And then Danny decided it was going to be a band, and it was going to be kind of like, it was in the punk era, and it had that feel to it, but he had a horn section, which was evidently a mortal sin in that world. I didn't know him at that point. I didn't get to know him until I was a vice president at A&M Records, and Oingo Boingo was on A&M. So I was working with them then, but I didn't really know them. Miles Copeland, who was a manager of the Police, and eventually the manager of Sting, came to me and said, "Do you want to get out of here?" Meaning A&M Records. And I said, "To where?" And he said, "We'll start a company together and we'll, you know, all that sort of stuff." So the company came into being in about 1983. And Miles was my partner for several years after that. And the company was called LA Personal Development, or LAPD.
And that's still your handle.
Yeah. But he had IRS Records, and his brother had FBI booking agents.
Right.
So we had LAPD management, and we did well. That, you know, the Bangles went on to sell millions of records, and Oingo Boingo, you know, Danny came out of that band, and a great band called Concrete Blonde I worked with at that time.
Okay, some heavy hitters.
I don't know who else. I don't know, but with the record companies I worked with, the Police. And before that, Rod Stewart, and just some great artists, Rush, things like that.
It's a major talent.
Yeah, I've been doing that. So I've been doing that since the 70s.
So your role really is as a manager, and can you explain that to people? What does that mean, an artist manager? You
just an artist manager? Well, people mix them up, managers and agents and such. A manager is... in charge of everything. Sounds a strong term, but I mean they oversee what the agent is doing, they oversee accounting, they oversee the career of the artist, all aspects of it. And some managers do, but most don't book dates. They have an agent doing that, and you know, it's kind of like being the CEO of a company, and the artist owns the company, but the CEO is running it for the artist. That's a way to describe it.
And are these usually independent guys or through labels? What's the relationship there?
Most of the people I worked with, I've been on labels, but I didn't. I did negotiate some deals for the Bangles and for Oingo Boingo and some other artists, but I'm representing them when I go into the record company.
So you're not working for any record company. You're not right. Managing them as a part of the label's overall duties. You're working for the artist.
Exactly. The first thing I had to do as a manager in 1983 was to go to A&M Records, where 2 weeks before I was vice president. And then I left, and the first thing I did was to go in and take Oingo Boingo off A&M Records. And I negotiated the deal, and we went and signed with MCA. So that's, you know, I was definitely on the other side of the fence at that point, because I'm going into my old label saying, we want out of here. And I knew they didn't particularly care for Oingo Boingo, so I knew I'd be able to work it out.
Oh, I see. Interesting.
Yeah.
And just to get into the details a little bit, if memory serves, management takes about 15% of the cut. Agents take like 10% of the cut. Is that kind of generally how it works out?
Managers are more 20%.
Now, okay. So whatever deal you're getting the artists, you're getting 20% of it. So it's right. A lot of money.
Can be.
And the agent who books the band...
That's
10%.
But that's 10% of live performance, whereas the manager is getting 20% of anything the artist does.
Every CD,
live
CD
sales, whatever. However, they get paid.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now they don't get paid at all. So.
Yes. They get paid live now. Bands get paid for live.
I guess that's where the money is. It's in live. It's starting your own cosmetics brands.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm working now with a great. Skunk Baxter, who was a founding member of Steely Dan, and he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of the Doobie Brothers, and he's tremendous, tremendous, one of a world-renowned guitarist. And I'm not looking at cosmetics for, you know, it's got to fit the artist.
Vodka.
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad.
Because musicians have to find other ways to make money because they're not selling CDs. These are these plastic round things. Yeah. And even before that, there were these black pieces
round
of
things.
Tar that went round and round.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't exist anymore. So, the vinyl exists and is actually, I'm told, on the rise in terms of sales.
Collectors.
I guess so. They're not gonna suddenly get back to where they were.
No.
You know? But they, I guess, we put out a vinyl of Skunk's album, which is it's his first solo album. He's been in all these bands and played on all these records and played live with so many people. He'd never done a solo album, so we put that out last year on BMG Records. It's an album called Speed of Heat, and it's a really interesting mix of music. Because he started recording it in something like 1989. And when he got a chance, he'd go into the studio and do another track. So it started out as an instrumental track. And then friends of his said, well, I'd like to sing on that. So there's a track with Michael McDonald singing, a track with Clint Black, the country artist, singing. It's a very, very interesting album, but he's playing his heart out.
Bringing in some top talent.
Yeah. Well, you go into a restaurant with Skunk Baxter, and if there's another rock and roll artist in there, he's going to know them. You know?
Even though he may not be that well known to the public. It looks to me like these days, in a way, it's even harder to be a musician than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Because, I mean, people at the top, if you're a Beyonce, if you're a Taylor Swift, she's a big... singer these days.
Yeah, okay. Hey, but you thought he'd let me know?
Yeah, you know, trying to. Yes. You can make $1 billion. I mean, not only from touring, but from your clothing
everything,
line.
Yeah, all that, yeah.
So it can be tremendous money for the very few top people.
Yeah.
But for everybody else, I mean, you can get 100,000 plays on Spotify and get a check for a nickel.
Yeah, it's absurd.
So in some sense, it's much more difficult to break through these days.
Then you try to get on the road and make some money on the road, but you can't make money on the road until you can prove you can sell tickets. And one of the strange things I ran into when I first started working with Skunk a few years ago was the promoters were saying, we don't know if he can sell tickets, because he was always in a band. It wasn't his name.
He was never a personality himself.
Well, he was to a lot of people, but he was not. He hadn't toured under his own name, so we had to go out and tour and play some nice places, but smaller places, so that we could prove to the promoters that it'll sell tickets. And so we did a couple of tours last year, and they basically sold out and went to Japan, and it was all very good. Now we're in a position to say yes, he can, but a lot of artists just. I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they can't be making that much money on the road. And, you know, I mean, some of them I think are with labels. And when you're with a label, the way it used to be, I don't know if it still is, but the label might pay for your tour, might help you.
Tour support, but yeah. They're taking all that money back.
Oh, yeah, then you owe it to them.
It's a loan.
Yeah.
And they're taking every... Well...
But it's not a bad loan. I mean, your band's out on the road, so it's a business loan.
I'll take that.
Yeah, if you don't break through, you can owe them hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Exactly. But so now it seems like it's much more difficult, but there's an illusion. Because it's like, well, anybody can get on TikTok or Instagram and blow up. Yes, this is true that anybody, you know, in a sense, it's much more accessible. It's not this big edifice of a label you have to get through. You can just post a song, and this afternoon, you could be famous and suddenly a worldwide star. But since there's millions or hundreds of millions of people all trying to do that,
yeah.
There's this ocean of noise.
Yeah.
You can't get above it. And then there's all kinds of people who are very happy to exploit this and sell you on ads, and we're going to get you followers, and it's all BS.
It's not all BS. There are people who legitimately do that.
Please give me their
name. You got to be real careful. You got to be real careful.
Yeah.
Because if they say... If they say, what's the wording they use? We'll get it to 500 stations. They're probably not lying. They may well get it to 500 stations, but that doesn't mean they're going to do anything after that. Doesn't mean they're going to work it. You got to work it. If you get one inkling from a radio station of interest, you got to work it. You got to. Without being obnoxious or anything, you got to try to get them to play it more and try to get another station to play it. And, you know, there are guys who do that for a living now.
And then there's the lazy... Well, I'm a radio host on KXLU. I get all kinds of emails promoting songs, but they clearly have no idea what kind of radio shows I have, because yeah. It's just not music I do at all. So, I mean, there's some work that has to be done on the part of the marketer or the musician, figuring out who will actually listen to it instead of just this wide broadcast that goes right to the
Some of that
trash.
Stuff might be coming from these people who say we'll send it out to 500 stations, and they don't care. They don't care what nothing they got. Yes, we sent it to that station. They're not lying. They're just not really working.
And if somebody actually knows what I do and sends me a song thinking it'll be good for my show, if it's any good, if it's broadcast quality, I will play it. So, you know, do the work, musician. So, we're talking from both sides right now of the difficulty getting ahead, but also me being some minor media personality. You know, I have to deal with this too on the other side of that as a curator.
How would you describe your show? What kind of music or what's the general mood?
I've had a lot of shows. My main one is a show featuring the DJ community, the underground DJ community. So I know like hundreds and hundreds of LA DJs, and even internationally. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that this stuff is generally not on the radio in the United States. If you go to Europe, there are stations that play a lot of house and techno and stuff. But like in Southern California, I'm like the only guy doing it. Then I have another show I'm very involved with I believe a mutual colleague, Mike Bone.
Oh, yeah.
And we're doing an Americana show on Tuesday nights. Cool. It's really his show, but I mentioned you to him, and he said, oh, yeah, I used to work with Mike back in...
Yeah, we're still good friends.
Oh, good.
I don't see him much, but we're still good friends.
Yeah, so Mike and me work together a lot, and he does a lot of storytelling, and I featured him on a lot of shows. But so that's that Americana show, but this right now is for a talk show. And, we'll throw in a little bit of music from, say, your roster to give people an idea of what you're up to. But where do you think things are going? I mean, it's such a crazy question that we always ask people who are in the industry, but it's almost... For instance, I'm promoting a song right now for Christmas, and I was talking to somebody who markets... And she said, well, 6 months ago, I would get your song on Spotify playlists. But now that's all being gamed. There's just tons of garbage. So that means nothing anymore. Yeah. 6 months, and that whole landscape has changed.
Yeah. It's changing all the time now. You know, it's just...
Any speculation?
I don't even know what record companies do anymore.
compared
to what they used to do anyway. They must be doing something, but they're not... To my knowledge, they're not paying their artists. And so, I guess the thing is that, again, to my knowledge, the record companies made the deal with Spotify and with Apple and whoever the hell else has these platforms, and they pay the record company. And it's up to the record company to pay the artist. And it's getting lost in there. You know, and there's some songwriters I know who used to be able to live pretty well off their catalog, who are looking for jobs. The money just isn't coming in anymore.
Again, unless you're some superstar.
Yeah, really big.
Everybody beneath the top tier is struggling. Yeah. I mean, there's session work or this and that. But so I guess there's no way really to speculate about what's going on or what the future holds, because... It's any opportunity immediately gets gamed and saturated with bots or
The only technology. Thing you can do, which has been the guideline all along, is persevere.
Mm.
You've got to persevere and believe in yourself, and if you really want it, keep going. But you got to be aware that you just may not get there to where you want to get. But I bet you land somewhere. I bet you, even if you're playing house concerts around the country, which are very pleasant, they're not big money makers. But if you're making enough money to go, out on some sort of 4 or 5 week tour somewhere, you may be breaking even. Hopefully, but you're also living your music. You're also what it is you want to do is happening. You're getting your music out there. It's just not on that big scale that can happen. It has happened to a lot of people, you know. I worked with the Bangles. This was back in the 80s. I worked with them for about 8 years, 8 or 9 years. But the first 4 years, we didn't make any money. I look back, I go, how the hell did we do that? But we, you know, they weren't making money, we weren't making money. But there was something that kept us all going, even if it was, you know, low level. And then when they did hit, you know, it
blew up.
Yeah. So, but those are different days. I mean, there's some great artists out there that are touring. I mean, like my friend, I don't know if you know Dan Navarro, but
Dan Navarro.
Yeah. He's such a voice and great songs, and he lives in Santa Monica, I think, but he's constantly on the road. He finally, I think about a year or two ago, bought a van like made into a home kind of, and that's how he gets around the country.
But he has to earn every dollar. He's working for it.
Yeah, and he's got a good following in other places outside of L.A., Chicago and D.C. area, and you know, there's places he goes to in the Midwest. And he's going all the time, and I don't talk to him that often, which is a drag, but every once in a while, I'll look at his schedule, and he'll be Chicago to, somewhere a few hours away. So I figure, oh, he's on the road right now. He's probably by himself, so I'll call him up. So you're doing okay? You know, you staying awake while you're driving? You know, it just goes all the time. But there's a lot of people like that who can make a living. I mean, he makes, you know, co-wrote We Belong for Pat Benatar. He still gets a lot of money on that, or at least he was last time I talked to him about it. So he's got something else to live on. Plus, he does a lot of voiceover work and a lot of Latino, when they put that language onto something, then he can be part of that.
He's the guy they call.
Yeah. So he's got a few things going for him, but he's just known as a singer-songwriter, and he's constantly on the move. And I'm just saying, as an example, there are a lot of people who I see touring all the time, and I'm just not sure how they're doing it.
Yeah, well, there's two things going on. One, you alluded to, when you're an artist of any stripe, you have to do your art. You have to sing your song, you have to paint pictures, or you start to wither inside. You just have to let the muse come through. So that is important for us, just to feel like a human being. But then the other part I think that artists, or particularly musicians, don't understand is that the business of it, selling or getting tours and so forth, that can be a very creative endeavor also. In fact, it has to be, because the easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit, somebody's already doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in this age when things change so quickly, you have to be creative as a business person and do something inventive and try something new. I mean, even to the point of, like, don't just, like, send your tune out to every radio. Like, find the people who play your music and make a personal connection with that radio host.
Yeah.
In other words, you have to really, business
yeah.
has to be something that's vital. Because if you're just pulling levers and doing the easy stuff, it's going to go nowhere. It's really the way it is for every business.
It is. It's every business. And anybody starting out in any business, it's got to go through a lot of crap to get to where they may want to be, whether it's tech business or industrial or whatever it might be. You got to work your way up the ladder, except for the owner's son who can jump the ladder a little bit, but
and perhaps tank the company.
Yeah, perhaps
he hasn't worked hard.
Yeah, so it's like that. It's kind of like in the music world. If you're a musician, you're starting a company. You're starting, yeah, I always liken it to, maybe you're starting a little corner store, but your plan is to have a chain of big stores someday. But you're starting at the little corner store. You work at it and you invest, you may get another little corner store, and then maybe someday you're off and running on the big deal. And then nowadays you crash. You crash, or you're going well. But so a musician is kind of starting on the little corner store, and they're going to work their way up to owning a big department store or whatever, however you'd put it. But like any industry, man, it's a tough ladder to climb. It's just a tough. I know so many good musicians and good songwriters and guys with credentials, or I say guys, musicians, whatever they may be, pretty credentials, and struggle a little bit.
Let's talk a little about some of the anecdotes, some stories you have. I know you work with Paul Winter. I'm a huge fan of his.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I respected him and respect him so much. I haven't talked to him in years and years. If he hears this, he may wonder, who the hell is that guy? It's been, since somewhere in the 80s. But the great thing was we were in New York once, and I don't know which ballet company it was, but it was a major professional ballet company. And he had set it up where he's going to their rehearsal hall, and he is making up music on the spot, and they're making up a dance to that music that they're hearing for the first time. It was fascinating, man. It was, and they would come up with great dances, and they'd never heard the music before. Paul had never heard the music before. It was just, it was great. He was very
improvised.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he did all these great, you know, in caves and
Taj Mahal,
yeah, right.
Pyramids.
Yeah, yeah. And I just loved his adventurous nature in addition to his musical talent.
Well, he kind of came out of jazz, but there was a little crop of musicians around that time in the 70s and 80s. There was a band called Oregon. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of jazz, but a little new age, but very visionary music, and he was part of that crew,
right?
And I think
within that crew he was experimental,
and he was the top of it, really.
Yeah.
And Oregon too. I love that band. I don't know where that music really is. What happened to that?
It's thread? Smooth jazz or
smooth jazz. Oh my god, they just filed off all the edges.
I don't know where it's going to.
Well, what about Rush?
Well, Rush. I grew up in Canada, and they, of course, are from Toronto. And when they came to, I was at Mercury Records, and the headquarters are based in Chicago. And a good friend of mine named Cliff Bernstein, who went on to be a major manager, he signed them to the label. And I, maybe because I was Canadian, and maybe because Cliff and I were good friends, and I was trying to do PR for them. I was doing a publicity at that point, and I couldn't get anybody interested in Rush. I think they just went over people's heads. They're great guys, and I drove around in their van, you know, before they were making any money. But one of the things I really remember was that we drove to Gary, Indiana, which out of Chicago, I don't know, a couple hours or something. And so they're not getting any radio play, and the press media is not talking to them. And they go to a venue in Gary, Indiana, and they're playing to about 1,000 people. How did these people hear about them? I don't know to this day. How did those 1,000 people hear about a band? There was no internet. There was nothing like that. It was just, you heard it on the radio and you checked it out there. But somehow the word got out. It was miraculous. And of course it grew on from there. But I always thought that was, I can't say I always understood their music. They were great musicians. And I grew up loving drums and being a drummer, and you know, Neil Peart as a drummer was knocked me out, you know. He was just fantastic. So the whole band was great. So it was an interesting thing, because I drove around in a van with them for a while. I didn't tour with them, but I'd meet them in Atlanta or something like that, and skip a couple of years, and I'm in Toronto, and Rush is playing Maple Leaf Gardens, which is, you know, Madison Square Gardens of Canada, big venue. And I'm in a van with a band called Wall of Voodoo. And we can't get down the street because the crowds are coming out from the Rush show. Huh. And I'm sitting in the van, and I'm like, I wish I had their phone number. You didn't have cell phones. You know, if they had a cell phone, I would have called them backstage and said, you know, but it was an interesting moment that we'd gone from driving in a van with them to being in a van while their major venue was emptying out. They did great.
Why the music gods smile upon one group and not another? Well,
yeah.
Please, if you figure that one out. Well, then you work with Rod Stewart.
Yeah, I actually worked with him before all the others. I was I was a journalist. I was at the Detroit Free Press, and I was writing mostly about music. And I guess they didn't have the term then, but I guess I was a rock journalist,
okay,
you know, in the early days of that. And I would bump into Dave Marsh at cocktail parties and stuff like that, because that's how we got dinner. His record company would have a cocktail party. And the Free Press, of course, was a huge newspaper. It was like the fifth largest newspaper in North America at the time, morning newspaper. But one day, a guy from Mercury Records flew into Detroit and took me out to lunch. And I thought he was a record company guy. He wanted to have lunch. He wanted to get me to write about some of his artists. It was one of those things, you know. No, he offered me a job as head of publicity for Mercury Records. And it was a lot more money, and it was Chicago. And it was... So I went. But I had never really done publicity before, so it was an interesting moment where... I was sitting in the office. I'll tell you this. I can't tell you exactly what he said because of the F word is in there. But first day of the job at Mercury Records, I've got a huge desk, a huge office, and two secretaries. Now, 3 weeks before, I was in a little, at a desk with a window and secretaries. What are you talking about? You know. So I just wasn't. Anyway, I got a phone call. And I get it from England. And even that's a little weird because I didn't talk internationally in those days. And I got on the phone and you could hear the guy say, "Hey, it's," and then it would all break up because, you know, communication, particularly international, was pretty rough in the, even in the 70s.
And expensive.
Yeah. I finally said, I just can't hear you, man. I'm sorry. And he's very clear. It all cleared up. All of a sudden, it's Rod Stewart.
Yeah,
and that's what I had met him as when I was a journalist. But anyway, that was right around the time where he released Every Picture Tells a Story album, on which was the song Maggie May, and he just took off. So as a fairly new publicist, I jumped in the deep end. Because I was dealing with Rolling Stone and I was dealing with all that because it was Rod Stewart. And I learned pretty quickly and got, you know, made a lot of contacts. And that led to things that I did for the next 7 or 8 years at Mercury Records. And then I came out to California to A&M Records. And that was just before the Police broke wide open. So I worked with them. And, you know, when you're working with these kind of A-level artists, whether you started with them at A-level or not, you're just engulfed in media, and whatever your job is a much bigger job all of a sudden. And
it's a wave hits you.
Yeah.
And you're holding on.
I remember the way we were talking. I've forgotten who else was in the room, but Rod was in the room, and we were telling him, I think his agent was telling him about playing Madison Square Gardens, and he said, we can't play there. I said, the guy's offered. There's an offer from the promoter. If somebody thinks you can play there. And it took a while for him to be convinced that they could play the Madison Square Garden.
They could sell some tickets and fill it up.
And they sold it out.
Oh.
He sold it out. So it was a big corner to turn at that point, you know, and in terms of confidence. But he was a good guy. He was, he is a good guy, I guess. I haven't talked to him for a while either, but... we had some fun. We would play pool and I'll tell you one thing.
Just hang out.
I'll tell you, this is how far back it was. He and I were in Chicago and we decided to go see The Godfather, which was a new movie at that point in the theaters. And we went to the theater right on State Street in Chicago. And we walked in. He was wearing a canary yellow suit with canary yellow high heel shoes. He dressed out in the world as he did on stage. He didn't wear jeans and then change to go on stage. He wore what he... And I had a blue jacket on and like salmon-colored pants. I was probably... I mean, it wasn't any Rod Stewart. But anyway, we're walking into the theater and I hear the usher say, "Well, look at her." And I never told him that, but and then we went in and we watched The Godfather, and it was a blast. But Yeah, we'd have some good times. And,
that's nice. You get to know the artists as people.
Yeah, exactly. That's the part of the fun of it.
Well, I'm talking with Mike Gormley, and you're at LA Personal Development, LAPERSDev.com. So when somebody comes to you now, what do you do with them?
Well, of course, it depends on stature and their history and that sort of thing of what you have to work with. If you have somebody who's absolutely brand new, you've got to really set up. Usually they just don't know about the business side, and you've got to really guide them as to what to do and get a website and get, just some of the basics. And then hopefully you can go from there, and you try to get them. Now you can release their music on, Spotify. They don't need a record company.
Sure.
So
you can
send it out there.
Yeah.
But you got to support that. You got to, just like any other thing, you've got to tell people it's there, or it just doesn't make any difference.
Because this ocean of material out there,
right?
It'll just get lost.
You got to somehow let them get a grasp. So at that level, you're working on real basics. With Skunk Baxter, I mentioned, he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's an amazing guy. He's got another life as a military advisor.
Oh, okay.
which is a fascinating story and a very active story. It's not any bull. He's a busy guy there. But we were at NAMM, the National Association of Music Merchants, big convention in Anaheim. It's one of the biggest conventions
NAMM
in the
convention.
World.
Yes, yeah. That's what we all try to get to.
And I hadn't seen it for a while, but Skunk is walking down a hallway, and I'm walking down the opposite way, and he's got a young guy with him, and he's taking him to Skunk going to give a speech or something, or be in a panel, I'm not sure what. And he said, "Hey, how you doing?" And I said, "I'm doing fine. How you been?" "It's fine." He said, you still doing management?" I said, "Yeah, still doing it. Do you want to be my manager?" I said, "Okay."
Okay, that's the way it works sometimes.
Just because he was at a point in his career, he wanted some things to happen, and they needed somebody who knew the business side. He's a smart guy. He knows a lot about the business, too, but he's an artist. He should be that, not,
Gotcha. An artist, right. We need people who know how to connect the dots and get it out in the world.
Yeah. So the latest fellow I'm working with is very interesting. His name is Shankar. And he's, as you may guess, from India, although he lives in L.A. mainly. But he has a tremendous career, and he's basically a violinist and with an Indian aspect to it. But he also does like pop music and so on. And he worked on the score with Peter Gabriel for, I think it was Temptation of Christ.
Oh, okay.
And he's been on a lot of big movies and as a writer, and you can hear him. You don't necessarily know it's him, but he does a lot of that kind of stuff with the film.
Another important guy, but you may not know him personally.
Yeah, but a lot of people do know him, he's been in India. He's back in L.A. now, and we're gearing up for some new music next year and some touring and that sort of thing, and. I met him through a guy named Richard Gibbs, who was a keyboardist in Oingo Boingo. Mm. And Richard met him back when Richard was going to Berklee School of Music, College of Music. Richard was in the audience, and he saw Shankar play, and he was blown apart by him. And this was many years ago now, but he stayed in touch with him, and he's helped him out, and he's used him. Richard does scoring work, and he's used Shankar on that. So he called me up one day and said Shankar, his manager he'd had for many years, had passed away. So I got a phone call saying, can you help out? And of course I was happy to help. I knew all about him. Mm. I had not met him. I knew all about him, and I felt there was a lot we could do. And so I started working with him now, and work with him on an international basis. And, you know, it's different, but he's very bright and very easy to work with. So we'll, you know, we'll put out some music and put him on tour. And I don't know if he'll become a rock star or not, but I don't think that's the goal, because when he plays, it's amazing. And he's got a voice. Am I hyping you too much here? I don't mean to. I'm just taking off. But anyway, he's got a very interesting voice that he uses as an instrument. He's not necessarily singing the song, but it's, I don't know what you would call it.
It's like an instrument. Yeah, of course. It's lovely.
It's beautiful. Well, anyway, he's got, so that's what I'm, who I'm working with, the new one, the roster. And I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be great.
Well, we'll put in a call to the music gods and see what we can do. Mike Gormley, your website is laperstdev.com. Thank you so much for coming in studio today.
It's my pleasure. It's fun reminiscing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Of it each and every day. Try not to miss a thing. Don't get in the way. Oh, all there is to savor, of all there is to learn. Make the most of life. There's no time to buy. Life is good, it is an art. It can be tough, but then, so what? Make the best of what you got. Take a look at yourself. Thank you.
Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the very interesting Mike Gormley and played music from artists that he's worked with. At the very beginning of the show, Ladies from Hell, that was by Jeff Skunk Baxter, and then after the interview, Masterpiece by Trevor McShane, and then Do It Again by Jeff Skunk Baxter. And we just wrapped things up with She Said by Trevor McShane. We'll be back next week with the very best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.